Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A nuclear crisis is growing in Japan that could dwarf the massive destruction from the earthquake and tsunami. Radiation leaks from a quake-damaged nuclear plant have forced 140,000 people indoors, and the threat of a catastrophic meltdown looms large. This hour on Point, Japan's unfolding nuclear crisis. And you can join the conversation. Can you even get your head around what's happening and unfolding in Japan? Are you thinking back to Chernobyl? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at the future of the nuclear industry in the United States. But joining me first from Tokyo, Japan, is Jonathan Sobel, Tokyo correspondent for the Financial Times. Jonathan, welcome. Thank you for your time.
Hi, Jane.
We'll start with this latest explosion and fire, which is apparently out now at this third reactor at the Fukushima nuclear plant. I know so much is changing by the minute. Give us the latest if you can, Jonathan.
Yes. In fact, we've had two explosions today, bringing the total number at the plant's reactors so far since Friday's quake to four. We had The number two reactor had an explosion in a pool of water underneath its containment unit, and then the number four reactor, which was off, turned off at the time of the quake, some of its stored fuel heated up and caused an explosion and fire as well.
So what does that mean as far as the radiation levels that are being released? Japan's prime minister warns that even higher levels of radiation will be released, have yet to be released. I know that radiation levels have subsided somewhat after surging earlier today. Where does it stand now?
Yes, I mean, there were surges in both cases. The first explosion early in the morning at reactor number two apparently released some radioactive gas, and then later when essentially the building outside of the storage fuel pool tore open because of the fire at number four, that released possibly even more radioactive material because, in fact, there was more fuel inside the spent fuel tanks at number four than there is in any of the actual reactors. So we're talking about fairly significant doses of radiation, at least in the immediate vicinity of the plant. Quite high doses were detected there, although they have fallen. But further away from the plant, for example, outside of the 20-kilometer evacuation area, they are elevated, but experts and the government are saying not an immediate threat to health. As far away as Tokyo, there are trace amounts of radiation in the air. But these are about twice normal, according to one monitoring agency I spoke to, which is worrying, but it essentially means that you get 2 days' worth of radiation from being outside in a single day. So still not enough to harm humans.
What about evacuations, Jonathan? I know the prime minister ordered them within, as you say, 20 kilometers, about 12 miles of the nuclear facility. How many people have been evacuated, and are those evacuations complete?
We're hearing about 170,000 people in the evacuation area. It is essentially complete. I think some emergency personnel are still staying. Of course, there will be people that the government had difficulty evacuating, either because they were immobile, elderly people confined to bed, for example. Of course, they're going house to house and trying to make sure people will join the evacuation, but you always get some people who want to stay home no matter what.
I'm reading several accounts, Jonathan, that many Japanese people do not believe the government. And they don't believe the government has been forthcoming about the extent of the danger and the radiation release, and that many more people are actually leaving their homes. Is that what you're seeing? Is that what you're hearing?
I'm not seeing that in Tokyo, to be honest. There has been an exodus of expatriate workers, people from other countries who have a place to go to. They have, an international company that's going to fly them out, essentially. Many people that I know personally have left for Singapore, for Hong Kong, for example. But that's almost I mean, that is almost exclusively confined to the foreign community. Among Japanese, I think I have heard reports of some people sending spouses, for example, to cities further west, but mostly the city in Tokyo is quite calm. There were people in the park outside the building where I'm working today, you know, children playing badminton. So that there's a real contrast between the mood in the city, which is tense underneath, but very, very calm as a whole, and, of course, what you're seeing, the reports from the Fukushima reactor.
Right, right. What about search and rescue efforts? You know, we continue to hear hundreds of bodies still washing up near the quake zone.
That's right. As well, the search and rescue effort itself is massive. There's 100,000 military personnel involved. That's Japan's biggest military mobilization since World War II. They're still having trouble reaching some affected areas. We are hearing reports that, bodies are washing up on shore. At the same time, there has been some good news from areas that hadn't been reached before. I think there's been a lot of reports on one town where 100,000 people were presumed to have been washed away. About 2,000 of those people have been contacted. Small blessings here and there.
Jonathan Sobel, thank you very much for your time. I know communication to Japan is shaky, and I know you were busy. We appreciate it very much.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Sobel is Tokyo correspondent for the Financial Times. He spoke with me from Tokyo. Joining me now in the studio is Charles Forsberg, research scientist in the Department of Nuclear Science and Engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and executive director at the MIT Nuclear Fuel Cycle Project. Nice to have you here, Charles.
Thank you.
And with us from Rockville, Maryland, is John Boyce, professor of medicine at Vanderbilt University and scientific director at the International Epidemiology Institute. John, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane.
Charles, I'll begin here in the studio. I'm reading the very latest AP Wire, which quotes a Japanese nuclear safety official as saying that the water inside the fuel storage pool at the damaged reactor may be boiling. After these explosions that we heard Jonathan just refer to and this fire, tell us what is happening in there.
The store spent fuel. The spent fuel has some residual heat production. And if you lose cooling in the spent fuel pond, the water heats up like water in a teapot. And if it heats up high enough, of course, the water will boil. The good news about that is, of course, is that it removes the heat safely from the pond. The bad news is you have to make sure that you add replacement water so the water doesn't disappear from the pond and you overheat the pool and the fuel. So the requirement for the Japanese is to make sure there's water in the pool.
And they've been pouring seawater in, or so they say.
Yes, it doesn't matter what kind of water. Seawater is just as good for this purpose.
But this is still happening, and explosions are still occurring.
Yes, the explosions are from hydrogen production as part of the accident sequences that have occurred, and I can go into that later. And so what you have is hydrogen in parts of the plant finds an ignition source and detonates, and that's what's starting the fires, and that's what blew off some of the roofs.
And the initial earthquake that started this.
That's, of course, what shut that down the plant. I can give you a very short history of this that might be useful. Japanese historically have designed plants for expected earthquakes, which is about a Richter 8 scale. The earthquake they had was 8.9, about a factor of 10 higher than historical Japanese experience. When the earthquake happened, several of the plants were running. They successfully shut down, and they went into their normal modes.
It was the tsunami that really
correct.
Took them out.
That was correct. A three-story tsunami, and it went right over the tsunami walls at the reactors and, of course, at the various cities.
Let me jump to the radiation levels now, Charles. We'll get back to this history in just a moment and what has happened. But John Boyce, help us understand the significance of this new amount of radiation that we understand has been released.
Well, it's somewhat difficult because of the reports on what the levels actually are.
Mm-hmm.
They are increased levels, as everything that I've read and heard, but the two issues are how high are the levels and are they reaching populations in a large amount. The one issue that did concern me in reading this morning's paper was that they've evacuated the workers from the reactor sites and have only left sort of a handful to keep trying to control the water levels in the various reactors. So that would indicate to me that the levels possible or are probable around the plant themselves might be increasing to levels of a human health concern, and the concern is there for the workers would be if the levels become high enough, could be acute. In other words, that they would possibly develop some type of radiation sickness.
So these radiation levels, the fact that they're surging and then subsiding, I mean, what does that mean? And does the decline in the radioactivity that we heard about just a little while ago mean that the situation may be getting a little better or not?
Well, that's what it would it seems to, from everything I've read, that you're right, there are releases, and I understand that some of these are just normal venting, but at the radioactive levels being much higher than during normal operation of the reactors because of the partial meltdown, and that these levels then are increased, but then they dissipate in approaching lower levels. The other factor, it seems to me, is which way the wind is blowing. And if the wind, in fact, is blowing out towards the seas, then the likelihood of population exposure, you know, the 12 miles and beyond the evacuation area would be very, very small. And at least from what I've been able to understand as of this morning, the population and the releases from the various reactors, from the incidents, they're relatively low and not yet at the level of health concern.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the growing nuclear crisis in Japan. We're speaking this hour with John Boyce, professor of medicine at Vanderbilt University and scientific director of the International Epidemiology Institute, and Charles Forsberg, research scientist in the Department of Nuclear Science and Engineering at MIT and executive director of MIT's Nuclear Fuel Cycle Project. John Boyce, let me go back to you. Tell us exactly with these releases of radiation, what chemicals are actually escaping?
Oh, it appears like during the normal fission reaction, you would get volatiles that would be released into the atmosphere, and in large part, these would be the radioactive iodines, cesiums, and perhaps other fission fragments, but those would be the radioactive isotopes of prevalence. There could also be some strontium, radioactive strontium, and then some other inert gases like xenon and krypton that would dissipate relatively quickly.
So the cesium and the iodine, those isotopes, I mean, how long do they remain radioactive? What's their half-life?
Well, and we have the experience also from the Chernobyl accident to give us guidance on the amounts of releases from reactor accidents. But the radioactive iodine, they have a half-life about 8 days. So they would be around, and if they got into the food supply or if people breathed the radioactive iodine, that could be a concern for your thyroid gland. All of that would be dissipated in say, 2 or 3 months, though, because of normal decay. The cesiums, the strontiums, on the other hand, they have a much longer half-life. They would a half-life is 30 years. Mm-hmm. That would mean, which means that after 30 years, you still have half of the radioactivity remaining. So contamination associated with the cesium or population exposures could last for a long time if there in fact were meaningful, you know, very large releases of the cesium isotopes.
Larger than we're seeing now?
Oh, well, yes, from what I understand. It looks like even at the levels there does not seem to be substantial levels that are being released. That's from what I read in the papers, is that the levels are not not great that are getting out into the environment.
But long term, if the levels do increase as far as the water supply, as far as food sources, what does that mean in the northeastern part of Japan and more broadly?
Yes, well, it all depends upon what the levels are, so that's really hard to predict. If you want to use Chernobyl as the benchmark, the problem there was really the radioactive iodines, and the major effect on the population was a large increase of thyroid cancer among the children that had drunk contaminated milk. What had happened was the radioactive iodine landed on the grass. Cows ate the grass. Cows gave milk, and then mothers gave the milk to their children. The thyroid acts like a sponge with regard to iodine, and it just sops them all up. And so the children who drank the contaminated milk got very large doses of radioactive iodine to their thyroids, and there were over 8,000. It was an epidemic. 8,000 developed thyroid cancer afterwards. The former Soviet Union, though, could have taken public health measures to eliminate that threat by simply telling the people not to drink milk. So that could have been averted. And then in the situation around Japan, I understand that the government has distributed potassium iodide tablets, which is normal iodine, which would block the uptake of radioactive iodine had there been any exposure.
And long-term, that takes care of it? Or what other precautions might there be?
Well, that would, for the thyroid, that would be, that would take care of it for the radioactive iodines. Mm-hmm. Don't drink contaminated milk. Mm-hmm. And if you took the iodine tablet, you would not be at much risk at all. That doesn't protect you. You know, it's not a magic pill and would not protect you from other exposures that you might experience. From the Chernobyl accident, though, at least in terms of the population, what we've learned, the major effect was only the childhood thyroid gland. And looking at childhood leukemia, it's and following the populations that live near Chernobyl, there's been not been any other increases of cancers or adverse diseases.
So is that somewhat surprising to you, studying this, or those who have, that there have been obviously many cases of cancer, but there have not been as many as perhaps might have been thought?
That's exactly right. Of course, cancer is a common disease, and about 40 to 50% of us during our lifetime will develop a cancer, and about 25% of us will die of cancer, so it's not relatively uncommon. But around the Chernobyl reactor and the studies of the cleanup workers who came to decontaminate the area, there's not been any elevation of cancer rates other than over expected, except for the thyroid cancer in the children. I want to add one qualifier, though, that it, you know, I don't believe this has happened yet, you know, around the Japanese reactors. There hasn't been a you know, a major meltdown and breach of the containment vessel, which would result in massive releases of radiation into the environment. When that happened in Chernobyl, and Chernobyl did not have a containment vessel such as the Japanese reactors have, the firemen and the people in plant worked day and night to try to put the nuclear fire out, and they received enormous amounts of radiation, the workers did. And it was, they received so much radiation that 28 of them died within 3 months. So they were the, I think they're called the heroes of the Soviet Union by sacrificing their lives to try to contain the release of the radioactivity and control the reactor fires. So right now, and from what I've read, the concern is that the levels around the Japanese reactors, you know, in the reactor area, they might be increasing to levels where there might be concern about the health for the workers.
Charles Forsberg, let me come back to you. This breach of the containment vessel that John Boyce refers to, what has to happen in order for that to break down in Japan, and how close are we to that, if you know?
Well, let me give a little background explanation what happens in an accident. The problem is when you shut down a reactor, the spent fuel continues to produce heat. initially it's at a very high rate, about 6% of the power output. That heat generation rate decreases rapidly. It's now down by a factor of 10 compared to when the reactors were shut down. If you don't cool the spent fuel, it'll overheat and fail and begin a melt accident. And some of that actually occurred at these plants because we know that hydrogen was generated. If you have high temperature steam plus the metal in the core, you produce hydrogen, and the hydrogen and steam then goes into the containment suppression pools. These are pools of water that scrub out some of the radionuclides and also condense some of the steam.
And so that breach of the containment vessel, that when that happens, that is, quote, the meltdown.
Well, the meltdown is of the reactor core. The containment vessel breaches means that you now have it escaping from the containment vessel. You can have a core melt and nothing happened. In TMI, we had a core melt and nothing happened. Mm-hmm. Now, what's been happening is the containment has been beginning to get pressurized. And so what they chose to do is they said, we cannot risk losing the containment, so we're going to release some of the gases from the containment to the larger building. And, of course, the gases that were released was the hydrogen.
And then you get the explosions.
And the hydrogen went into the regular part of the building, which was not part of the nuclear safety section, and it found a source of ignition, and it blew up. Mm-hmm. But understand, they were releasing the hydrogen as a safety strategy to protect the containment and make sure that it did not overpressurize. So
it was very helpful. That's an explanation I haven't heard. Yes, thank you very much. Let me get a call in here. Joe from Fairfield, Connecticut. Joe, welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, thank you. And what a horrific set of circumstances
Yes.
we're talking about.
Yes.
I worked in the region, Asia-Pacific region, for several years, and I have some good friends in Tokyo, and the best way to describe their sentiment these days is terrified. They're literally, not figuratively, looking to see which way the wind's blowing in terms of how any kind of radiation released might be coming inland versus going out to sea. And one of the things that they've discussed with me is a slight feeling of hysteria around the concept of what a certain generation of us were brought up thinking about from the movie The China Syndrome, mm-hmm. in terms of what might be the most extreme event that might occur. So if there can be any commentary on that, I'd appreciate it. And also, the sentiment coming from my friends as well is a slight distrust of the government's ability to even render accurate information as to what's happening. There seems to be quite a bit of confusion in terms of the news and the dispatches, and the government seems to be at times contradicting itself in terms of what's happening. So any commentary?
Joe,
on that?
Thank you. The confusion level is very high, Charles, as you were telling me before we started this.
Yes. In a real-world accident, what you have is control rooms with alarms going off, all sorts of signals, and remember, you can't go walking into the reactor and see what condition it is. So what you have is you're reading dials, instruments, TV screens, and you're trying to figure out what goes on. And the consequences of that is you have a very confused situation, and it'll be obvious in retrospect what happened. But it may take 6 months after the accident to actually understand what happened. And so confusion is the normal state of affairs in these kinds of events. These are very slow-moving accidents.
And the caller's question about about China Syndrome, which I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, a complete, meltdown to the core of the Earth, myth or reality?
Partial.
Yeah.
If you have a major core melt, and they've obviously had some core melt,
yeah.
You're going to melt down into the bottom part of the containment structure and go a couple of feet into it. It'll eventually stop. But the concern, of course, is if it goes deep enough is that you create additional gases and pressurize the containment. The entire game is to make sure that containment stays tight and holds everything in. But you can have core debris all over the floor.
John Boyce, Joe mentioned that his friends are literally looking at the wind, where it's blowing. Does it come down to that, a shift in the wind as far as this radiation being carried?
Well, certainly that would be with regard to the population exposure, and the prevailing winds appear to be going out towards sea, which further minimizes the radioactive exposure to the population. But, you know, he raises a very good point about not hysteria, but the psychological problems. And if we reflect back on what has happened to the Japanese population during this past week, what a triple whammy. First, you have this huge earthquake, and then it's followed by an enormous tsunami, whereas your correspondent correspondent earlier this morning mentioned that hundreds, if not thousands, of bodies are still washing up on the shore from the terrible, terrible effects of this natural disaster. And then you have the third prong. You have the possibility of a nuclear crisis or a nuclear accident that would release meaningful amounts of radiation into the environment, contaminate the environment, and cause havoc, you know, in that local area. These are all horrific things. So the psychological effect on the people must be enormous, you know, what they must be thinking. And this happened around Chernobyl, the population, increased risk of mental disorders. Many of the workers that came back, that came to Chernobyl to clean up the radioactive debris and went back to their homelands, they had increased rates of suicides from not just the potential scare of radiation, but the whole disruption of your lives and being evacuated and all of that. Right now, the psychological problems just be enormous among the Japanese population, and especially those that are living near and have been evacuated around the Fukushima reactors.
Charles Forsberg, in the best case scenario, how long will it take for this situation to stabilize?
It isn't going to be a yes, no. It's going to be a slow stabilization, probably over a week or two. And that's simply because what you have is two effects. You're trying to control the situation by adding water, but you also have radioactive decay that is slowly eliminating the problem with time. And it's a question of when your cooling crosses over and the decay rate is sufficiently low that the cooling works. But the problem will be is you may stop the accident, but it may be a week before you know that you've actually done it. There's the catch.
I wonder also about those U.S. nuclear experts who are traveling to Japan to help, and others certainly from around the world. Do they take special gear with them, or do they just assume the risk that they will be exposed to radiation?
The Japanese have a very large nuclear establishment, so when it comes to equipment, if you need any specialized equipment, you can pick it up in Japan. There would be no need to bring such equipment except a few special cases over. Remember, they have a very large nuclear program, a very large enterprise, so they've got lots of people, and the vendors are in Japan today that can provide the additional equipment.
John Boyce, what do you see as the risks radiation-wise for Tokyo for some of the larger cities in Asia?
Right at the moment, none. I don't think the radiation levels are of even close to where we could even find or make reasonable estimates of what long-term cancer risk would be. The levels are just of the order of what we receive from natural sources of radiation. You know, we live in a sea of low-level radiation. We're breathing radon right now. We have radioactivity in our bodies from the food we eat, uranium and potassium. When we fly, we get exposed to cosmic rays. So there's this very low level that we exist in, and the amount of radiation, you know, that's at this moment possible to Tokyo and the surrounding populations, way beyond the 12-mile evacuation zone. Mm-hmm. From everything that I've read, they're just trace amounts of radiation and very low levels. So there's not a concern about future. Future health risks. The only issue would be if, in fact, there turned out to be, as mentioned, a breach or a breaking down of the containment vessel where there would be massive amounts of radioactivity released into the environment. That's where there would be concern for the population exposures.
John Boyce, I know you have to run. We really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Jordan.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at the growing nuclear crisis in Japan. On Sunday, Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut told CBS's Face the Nation that the Japanese reactor catastrophe should force the U.S. to reevaluate its safety precautions.
I've been a big supporter of nuclear power because it's domestic, it's ours, and it's clean. But we've had a good safety record with nuclear power plants here in the United States. I don't want to stop the building of nuclear power plants, but I think we've got to kind of quickly put the brakes on until we could absorb what has happened in Japan as a result of the earthquake and the tsunami, and then see what more, if anything, we can demand of the new power plants that are coming online.
On NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday, Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer of New York said that the United States needs to take a closer look at nuclear energy, even in light of what happened in Japan.
The bottom line is we do have to free ourselves of independence from foreign oil in the other half of the globe. Libya showed that. Prices are up. Our economy is being hurt by it, or could be hurt by it. So I'm still willing to look at nuclear. As I've always said, it has to be done safely and carefully.
We're speaking this hour with Charles Forsberg, research scientist in the Department of Nuclear Science and Engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and executive director at the MIT Nuclear Fuel Cycle Project. And joining me now from Washington is Ellen Vanko, Nuclear Energy and Climate Change Project Manager at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Before joining the Union of Concerned Scientists, she spent 25 years working on energy policy at the North American Electric Reliability Council, Allegheny Energy, and the Edison Electric Institute. Nice to have you with us, Ellen.
Thank you very much, Jane.
And with me from Washington also is Jason Grumet, president of the Bipartisan Policy Center, started in 2007 by a bipartisan group of senators. Since 2001, Grumet has directed the National Commission on Energy Policy, NCEP, which is a group of 20 energy experts that make energy policy recommendations. He was energy and climate change advisor to the 2008 Obama campaign, and 7% of the Bipartisan Policy Center's funding comes from corporations that produce electricity using nuclear power. Jason, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. I think that last statement's a little bit exaggerated, but we do receive a
Okay. About how much, then? Sorry to get that wrong.
About 2%.
Okay. Thank you for the correction. Tell us first, what percentage of our energy comes from nuclear energy in this country?
Well, Jane, 20% of our existing electric power comes from nuclear energy, and I think as or more important, 70% of the non-carbon electricity we produce comes from nuclear. And you know, here at the Bipartisan Policy Center, we kind of exist in this crucible of diverse opinions. And while there are a lot of pros and cons, what our group, I think, has come together around is the view that we have to do everything we can as a country to promote non-carbon energy, including aggressive efforts to try to pursue safe nuclear power.
And has the situation in Japan changed that focus?
Well, I think, you know, the situation in Japan has caused everybody who thinks about these issues at all to step back and take a, you know, hard swallow. You know, our democracy is not always driven by physics. And so when people say we need to, you know, step back for a little while, I don't think that's just a cliche. It's a recognition that the dynamics are unfolding quickly. I think, you know, the narrow question about whether a quake and a tsunami could impact the U.S., in my mind, is really not the issue. I think that the likelihood there is not something to be overly concerned about. Broadly, the question is whether the failure to anticipate this combination of events, combined with the failure to anticipate the terrible tragedy in the Gulf with the Macondo facility, suggests to us that we have a basic challenge in whether we can design margins of safety to guard against what is essentially unimaginable.
Ellen Vanko, before the earthquake and tsunami in Japan, the Union of Concerned Scientists had come to the conclusion that the arguments against nuclear energy outweighed the arguments for it. Can you explain why?
Well, the safety and security issues have become patently obvious to everyone, so I don't really need to repeat them. I think it's playing out on our television every day, and that's one of the things that UCS has always been concerned about. But I think more to the point on where the nuclear renaissance in the United States was before this event happened, it was already in trouble. Spiraling cost estimates, declining energy demand due to the recession, low natural gas costs, and the failure to place a price on carbon already spelled trouble for the industry. Just last week, John Rowe, chairman and CEO of Exelon, the nation's largest nuclear company, told the American Enterprise Institute that he would not invest in new nuclear reactors because they're uneconomic compared to other low-carbon alternatives like energy efficiency, natural gas, and uprates at existing nuclear reactors. I would add cost-effective wind and other renewable technologies to his list, but in general, I agreed with everything he said.
Well, to Jason's point, let me ask you, can we design better safety and security mechanisms that would change your thinking about nuclear energy moving forward?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is learn from the accident in Japan. And that actually is probably going to result in the first impact on reactors in this country. You know, the impact will be on existing reactors. A thorough assessment is needed to ensure that the reactors we already have are being operated as safely and securely as possible, that existing NRC regulations and reliability standards governing nuclear plant safety and security are fully enforced, and that any necessary improvements to those regulations and standards are identified and implemented quickly. Of course, that's for existing reactors. To the extent we can make proposed reactors safer and even more reliable and do a more thorough risk assessment before we decide to build one, that's going to be absolutely essential as well.
Jason Grumet, although it seems increasingly unlikely, although one hopes otherwise, but if Japan is able to limit the damage of this catastrophe, could what's happened there be seen as a success story then for nuclear energy moving forward here?
Well, I don't think anyone could describe this obviously as a success story. I mean, you know, we right now are, I think, you know, teetering on the precipice of something which is very, very problematic to something which is potentially, you know, catastrophic. And you can't help but think about the, you know, 50 engineers who are putting their own, you know, lives in danger for the safety of the rest of the country. However, it is certainly worth recognizing that a 40-year-old reactor seemed to sustain a 9.0 magnitude earthquake. And what really apparently has caused this incredibly complex system to now start to spiral into failure is the loss of electric power, which from a, you know, power generation system is actually, unfortunately, sadly, somewhat ironic. But what happened was the tsunami basically knocked out the backup generators and washed the fuel supplies away, making it impossible to bring basic electric power to the facility, which is essential to cool down the reactor. And so I think when you look at what the focus will be likely here in the U.S. to our existing units, I think it's largely going to be focused on the question of whether there is adequate access to emergency power in our existing facilities when unexpected combinations of harm occur. You know, post 9/11, there has been a focus and an effort at the NRC to improve emergency access to power, and there's going to be, I think, a necessary effort to assess whether we think those efforts are adequate.
I got to get some calls in here. Let's go to New York first. Beth is on the line. Hi, Beth. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'll try to keep this brief.
Yes.
I live a couple miles from where we had a small leak, and it did occur to me we had an animal pass away recently, and I didn't know the symptoms of radiation sickness, and I'm saying, not saying that's what it was, but it was very similar. But, you know, the point is that you can't prepare for what you don't know. And it's not like falling off a bike. And the amounts of money that have to go in life that have to go into this stuff is huge. The amount of money to make sure it's quote-unquote safe. When you can't plan for a mouse chewing through a wire or whatever, you can't plan for everything that you can't possibly imagine. And I think people like Chuck Schumer should be investigated. I think it's time to sever all financial ties between government and nuclear power, because to come on the air after this accident and say what he did was unconscionable.
Beth, thanks for the call. Here's John in Tennessee. John, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. I do live in Tennessee. We have nuclear facilities throughout the state, ran by the Tennessee Valley Authority, or some of them at least. And as recent as yesterday, there was a report from the spokesman coming out saying, you know, Tennesseans, don't worry, we're not on any fault lines. And I just want to ask your guest, is that a responsible assessment to that? Or, you know, if I look at the topography, there is a fault line that has been dormant for some years. And no, we're landlocked, we wouldn't have a tsunami, but, you know, I'm just curious, is that the type of approach that we should go about it? Or should we be more, you know, questionable about what the people whom are run the facilities, you know, say?
Is it responsible for them to say, just don't worry, John? Thanks so much. John Grimay, would you answer the caller?
Yeah, well, look, you know, amidst this incredible unfolding tragedy, people are focused on the specific facts of this situation, which are this horrendous calamity of earthquake and tsunami. And I think for the Tennessee Valley Authority, I think for the people who are under tremendous scrutiny, who are the only folks trying to, I think, site new reactors in Georgia in the 2016-2017 time frame, I think it is responsible to say that fact pattern is not something that people should be worried about here in Tennessee and here in Georgia. There is, of course, a broader consideration that is beginning and going to, I think, you know, continue for months and years about whether there are other fact patterns that have not been anticipated, other improvements to design that are necessary, and whether, in fact, and I very much agree with Helen's earlier point that, you know, it is largely the economics of nuclear power that have the renaissance on its back foot here in the U.S., and, you know, certainly wrong to imagine that we were on the verge of a nuclear expansion, you know, prior to this terrible accident.
Here's David with another point from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Thank you to you and your guests for an excellent program.
Thank you.
Coupled with the problems that we're having now, I read this in a Newsweek article recently. The NRC has mock make-believe attacks on nuclear facilities to test their security procedures and their readiness for any kind of an attack from outside forces. An alarming number of these mock attacks are successful. Upwards, my recollection was in the 40% range. But if you couple that with the fact that we do not have a cohesive policy currently in place for storage of spent nuclear fuels, that means that many of these facilities are actually storing the waste spent fuels in their facility. Mm-hmm. What do we do about that?
All right, David, thank you. Ellen Vanko, to David's first point, I mean, what kind of protections would you like to see in plants, given this Newsweek story he referred to?
Well, I'd like to see better protections. I can't give you a list. I know there are experts in that field who could. What is more alarming about the issue the caller just raised is the fact that not only do these plants fail a significant number of these tests, but the plants are notified well in advance of the fake attack that it's coming. So imagine what the failure rate might be if they receive no notification whatsoever. That's something very important to keep in mind.
Here's another call from Charlestown, New Hampshire. Hi, Phil. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, your experts in the previous segment were very technically savvy, and I didn't sense a bit of giddiness, but they were almost excited to see this unfold, not in a weird way, but just a technical way. They were just learning all about it. And my point is there no part of our human existence on this planet that should be sort of separate from a just a generic cost-benefit analysis? It just seems like every expert says, no, don't worry, it won't happen here. The cost-benefit analysis says, and, you know, the odds tell us that everything is going to be fine. It just seems like when the odds go south and we're on the losing side of something like this, that the catastrophe is just so horrific that a standard cost-benefit analysis just doesn't make sense. Can your experts sort of
chime in on that? Yes, Phil, thanks so much for the call. Charles Forsberg.
Yeah. Yes, the issue is what are the alternatives? The Japanese program is a consequence of World War II. The Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor as a preemptive move to take over oil fields in Southeast Asia. That failed. As a consequence, the Japanese concluded that nuclear power was cheaper than war, and that's why they have a nuclear program. The French have the other large nuclear program. After the French-Algerian War, 500,000 troops bombings in Paris daily, they came to the conclusion that nuclear energy was less expensive, and more importantly, far less risky than continued wars in the Middle East. Thus, the two largest programs outside of the United States were driven by decisions of war and peace and not economics. And that was because of the bitter experience of both Japan and France.
Mm-hmm. Jane, I think the caller makes an important point. And a number of people have used an old aviation metaphor to say that nuclear power, while not inherently unsafe, is inherently unforgiving. And I think that we find with a lot of these complex systems a certain question about our own humility and whether we, as a society, have the ability to manage these processes. From time to time, we find that we don't. At the same time, we need to have a larger vision for energy in this country. You know, in the last few years, we have seen seemingly unanticipated tragedies at most of the major energy production, or types of energy production facilities that we rely on. And to have, at this very moment, the Congress of the U.S. Debating even amidst our tremendous debt to reduce the investment we make in developing new energy technologies strikes me as very short-sighted.
Alan Manko, I'll give you the last word and let you respond to Jason Grumet, this point about needing a larger vision for energy in this country.
Well, we agree that we have to do everything we can to respond to climate change as quickly and responsibly and as cost-effectively as possible. Unfortunately, we've just been reminded that the large-scale expansion of nuclear power in the United States or worldwide under existing conditions would be accompanied by an increased risk of catastrophic events. One lesson we can draw from the unfolding disaster in Japan is that no matter how technologically advanced we are as a society, and I think Jason was getting to this point, it's impossible to fully plan for every curveball Mother Nature or a terrorist can throw, or to prevent catastrophic events from affecting our critical infrastructure. And this includes roads, bridges, power plants, and telecom systems. Japan's going through all of that right now. This is not just about a nuclear disaster. It's about a national disaster. And we have to keep that focus as we continue to understand and try to help the people of Japan get through this crisis.
We will continue this conversation in many days to come. Alan Manko, thank you very much. Joining me from Washington, nuclear energy and climate change project manager, union of concerned scientist, Jason Grumet, president of the Bipartisan Policy Center, started in 2007 by a group of senators, and Charles Forsberg, research scientist in the Department of Nuclear Science and Engineering at MIT. Many thanks to all of you for your input this hour. You can continue the conversation online. Listeners, thank you as well for your input. I'm Jane Clayson. In for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.